Welcome, everyone, to the Fiat Money Crisis, the Market, the Central Banks, and the Coming Monetary Breakdown, a webinar with Detlev Schlichter. I'm Danny Sanchez, the administrator of the Mises Academy. A few technical notes. If you would like to interact, to communicate, you can. There's two ways. You can use the chat panel. Make sure to select send to participants, all participants, and that way you can chat with everyone. But in order to submit a question for Detlev to answer, the place to do that would be in the Q&A panel underneath the chat panel. And during the Q&A period, those questions there will be addressed. Our presenter, Detlev Schlichter, is a writer and Austrian school economist. He had a 19-year career in financial markets. From 1990 to 1998, Detlev worked at J.P. Morgan & Company as a derivatives trader and portfolio manager in Frankfurt and London. In 1998, Detlev joined Mercury Asset Management in London as the director and portfolio manager for European bond portfolios. Mercury was later acquired by Merrill Lynch and became Merrill Lynch Investment Managers. From 2001 to 2009, Detlev was head of the London-based investment team and lead portfolio manager for all global portfolios at U.S. bond firm Western Asset Management. He resigned in 2009 to focus exclusively on his first book, Paper Money Collapse, The Folly of Elastic Money and the Coming Monetary Breakdown, which will be published by John Wiley and Sons in September 2011. Detlev holds a degree in economics and business administration from Ruhr Universität Bochum, Germany. He is a senior fellow at the Cobden Center London, a free market think tank devoted to issues of money and banking. Detlev lives with his wife and three children in Hampstead, London. Please join me in welcoming Detlev Schlichter.
Thank you very much, Danny. Good evening, everybody, and thank you very much for joining me for this webinar. It is indeed a great honor to be invited by the Mises Academy to hold this webinar. I mean, I've been a Misesian for many years, and if you read my book, you will see that I indeed owe a great intellectual debt to Ludwig von Mises. My book is firmly based on Austrian school economics, in particular on Mises' and Hayek's work on business cycles and on monetary problems. And obviously yesterday was Mises' 130th birthday, so here I am one day later doing the seminar. So I'm really delighted for this opportunity. I hope you enjoyed as well. Obviously, maybe I should give the usual disclaimer. I will be talking about the financial crisis and we'll be talking about my interpretation of how we got here and what I think will happen next. These are obviously my personal views. I don't intend to give any investment advice, and as you all know, neither me, myself, nor the Mises Institute can be held responsible for anything you do with your own assets after this presentation. But I can assure you that what I will be talking about, these are my honest opinions, and I do hold them with considerable confidence. So I prepared a few slides. I hope everybody can see them. It's nothing too spectacular on these pages. It's simply just a couple of bullet points that hopefully help you to follow my line of argument and my train of thought. The title of this webinar is The Fiat Money Crisis, and this is indeed how I think you should look at this this crisis. I think the first point is really to develop a framework of how to look at what we're going through and put it in some kind of context. I think this is important because the way this crisis is being portrayed by a lot of the mainstream media and many economists, I think can be very misleading. Many people speak about this crisis simply as if it's just another business cycle. There was a financial markets problem which led to a recession, and now we are working our way out of the recession. And there has been now this talk about a so-called double dip, which again I think is nonsense, because it implies that we've already come out of this, that we had a recovery, and for some unfortunate reason, we're now drifting back into a new recession. The truth is that we never came out of this crisis. This crisis started in 2007, and it is still with us. None of the problems, the underlying problems that are the reason for this crisis, have been solved by the policymakers. I would argue quite the opposite. Many of the policy measures have been entirely counterproductive and have probably worsened the crisis. What did happen, however, was that after the collapse of Lehman Brothers in 2008, we had a very aggressive effort around the world by major central banks to expand bank balance sheet, to inject bank reserves and central bank money into the financial system, and thereby arrest the collapse and the contraction of the system, and even cause some parts of the financial system to expand again. This strategy was partially successful for a while. It conveyed a feeling of stability again, and it projected a mirage of sustainability and normalcy again, which obviously was short-lived. And what we see now is that some of the problems that have never gone away are resurfacing again. So this is not just another business cycle. It is a systemic crisis. And I do think it can only be fully understood and it can only be fully appreciated if we put it in the context of our fiat money system. The present crisis is the inevitable outcome of our decision 40 years ago to abandon any link to gold or any other hard commodity and adopt a system globally of ever expanding our paper money or fiat money under central bank control. In this system, bank lending is to a large degree directed by central banks. Central banks can create bank reserves out of nothing, encourage further bank lending. Central banks control all short-term interest rates and therefore can incentivize the banking system to continue expanding. The dislocations and the imbalances that are at the heart of this problem we face today, in both their nature but also in terms of their magnitude, can only really be the result of such a system, of a decades-long creation of ever more fiat money. Or to put it the other way around, if you look at how our system is constructed, it is clear that such a system must over time accumulate more imbalances, and that at some stage these imbalances must be so meaningful that a further push into again another expansion becomes ever more difficult for policy to engineer. And I do think we've basically reached that point. I think I will speak a lot about the position of what I call the mainstream industry or the mainstream economics versus the Austrian school. I do think the present crisis is much better to understand from an Austrian perspective, and I think it's part of the reason why the Austrian school is now going through a renaissance. The Austrians, and in particular Ludwig von Mises, explained business cycles by looking at their monetary origins. If you summarize the theory, I don't want to go too much into the theory. This webinar is not really about theory, but if you just summarize the key tenet of the Austrian business cycle theory, it is clear that a growing economy requires a growing investment, and if that is funded by credit expansion on the basis of savings, you do get sustainable growth. But if credit expansion and investment are funded by money printing, you get a boom and bust cycle. That is the key message, if you like, of the Austrian business cycle theory. If credit is allowed to expand in such a way that credit becomes available, that interest rates are lowered, and credit becomes available that is not based on savings but simply on money printing, it means that there is a disconnect in the economy between savings on the one side and investment on the other. And that imbalance will mean that at some stage, the credit boom must turn into a credit bust. And von Mises told us that once this happens, you know, once the economy has accumulated these imbalances, there is actually no way you can avoid the recession. At that point, the recession becomes both inevitable and necessary, because the recession is the process by which the economy liquidates the misallocations and goes back to some sustainable structure, to a sustainable direction of economic activity, to sustainable asset prices, to sustainable leverage ratios. Yeah, the recession is a painful process, but it is inevitable once you had an extended credit boom. And the policy advice from the Austrians was also very clear. It was this: if you want to avoid a business cycle, you should avoid the artificial credit boom. You should make money less elastic, not more elastic. You should make fractional reserve banking or credit creation by balance sheet expansion more difficult. Throughout his life, Ludwig von Mises was an advocate of a 100% gold standard, meaning a gold standard with no fractional reserve banking. I think we can have a discussion, and I think reasonable people can disagree about to what extent that can be enforced or should be enforced, and I have my views on this. It's not really for the seminar to discuss this, but I can see obviously where Mises came from, and the policy advice was very, very clear and very sensible. But we all know that in the 20th century we went exactly the opposite direction. Now, policy from the founding of the Fed in 1913 to the present day did everything to make money more elastic, to sever any ties to hard commodity money or to gold or any other commodity that would constrain the production of money. Because the mainstream, and this is true to this day, and I think it is very much reflected in current debates about this crisis, the mainstream today, most mainstream economists, cannot perceive of the disruptive effects of an expanding money supply. If you listen to the economic debate in policy circles, I think through most of financial markets, certainly among central banks, it is very clear that people only see one negative impact of an expanding money supply, and that is inflation. It is very clear that if you inject more money into the system, the purchasing power of the monetary unit will decline. That's what people call inflation today, mainly measured by consumer price inflation. And if you don't have that, or you have it in a tolerable degree, there is no problem with monetary expansion. And monetary expansion is never perceived in itself to be a problem. I think the Austrian school understands that an expanding money supply, an elastic money, has many more negative impacts on the economy than just simply inflation. An expanding money supply must disrupt relative prices and lead to capital misallocations. And that is something that the modern mainstream, the macroeconomic mainstream, does not really understand. It sounds unfair, but I think it's also due to their tools, because modern mainstream economics is driven by statistical aggregates, by looking at national account statistics, GDP statistics, the price level. It's all focused on these macro variables, and they don't cover things like resource allocations, the reflection and interest rates of time preference, and all these finer details of the Austrian theory. And in that sense, we've adopted a monetary system that encourages monetary expansion and creation. And I don't think that most economists today perceive that there is really any difference between whether a credit expansion and investment boom is funded by savings or by credit creation through banks. And in fact, the system now is very much structured in such a way that it encourages credit creation and the funding of investment and capital stock via bank credit creation. So I'd call this point here from an Austrian business cycle to the credit super cycle. And this process, this transition away from gold to a fully elastic monetary system, was only really completed in 1971. I think very few people appreciate today how fairly young our monetary system is in its present form. Up till 1971, we did not have a gold standard. But after the Second World War, the US dollar became the global reserve currency, and central banks around the world started to use dollar reserves as their central bank reserves. And until 1971, the US government extended a promise to all these central banks that they could exchange their dollar reserves at a fixed price for physical gold at the US Treasury. And it was on the 15th of August 1971 that President Nixon decided to default on this promise, to close the gold window. And from that moment on, even among central bank circles, the dollar became simply an irredeemable piece of paper. But it also meant that from now on, the dollar still maintained the status of a reserve currency, but now there was no constraint on its production. You know, from then on, the U.S. Fed could create literally as many dollars as it wanted. You know, since then, there is around the world really no constraint at all in terms of fiat money production. And it's very clear to me that the dislocations around the world and made all the major financial crises of the recent years and decades are the result of this decision. And the present crisis is really nothing but the culmination of 40 years of credit boom that was ever more extended and with ever further incentives to create credit. And I think the key difference here, you know, this system compared to the gold standard systems we discussed earlier, you know, the systems in which Mises developed his theory, is very clear that now in our system, when an artificial credit boom is generated by lowering interest rates to artificially low levels, lowering interest rates to levels that would not be justified by the available pool of savings, but lowering interest rates by injecting liquidity into the system and creating money. Then when this happens, again a credit boom starts, and the Austrian theory tells us that again there is a mismatch between saving and investment and misallocation of capital. But when now the cleansing recession threatens to kick in, this recession is basically being aborted or short-circuited by the central banks. They can now manage these recessions, and this is a phrase that has become sort of popular in that we had managed recessions over the last 30, 40 years in which central banks step in, arrest the contraction of credit. The recession is no longer allowed to unfold in an uninhibited way. Is no longer allowed to cleanse the economy of the imbalances. So these imbalances must accumulate, but it's very clear that as that happens, the imbalances get bigger, the economy gets ever more sensitive to even a slowing of the money flow, and any upset in this money creation process, any disruption, will immediately lead to a sharp response in the real economy. The economy is, if you like, increasingly addicted to cheap credit and then ever more support from the central bank. The central bank needs to lean ever more aggressively against a correction of the system, which becomes ever more overdue, if you like. So we've been doing this in one shape or another for pretty much 40 years, and I think it's already clear that in the last 10 years that I was in financial markets, it was very clear that the crises became more became sharper, they became more severe, and that required ever more of a policy push, ever more of an initiative to restart the system and keep the system expanding. If I look back, I don't know if some of you remember, but in 1998, the hedge fund LGCM collapsed and Russia defaulted in the summer of 1998, and that threatened to start a process of deleveraging among the global financial system and the banking system. Back then, it only took the Fed a couple of intermediate rate cuts to stop that process and to basically give some encouragement to the system to continue expanding, balance sheet repair by the banks was stopped, and the system again expanded. And at that time, the phrase was coined of the so-called Greenspan put. And this continued very much. Obviously, then we had the Nasdaq bubble in 2000, 99 and 2000. And when that popped and the U.S. went into a slight recession, the U.S. Fed kept interest rates for 3 years at 1%. And now it already required a much bigger policy push to avoid a further contraction of the system. But that was managed again, and the system expanded, and the Fed moved rates higher, only to about 5%, because obviously the system now could not deal with higher interest rates. It was addicted to, you know, low rates and cheap credit. It was so extended already. And we all know that when the subprime crisis started in 2007, the Fed ultimately had to go to zero interest rates, and we're still at those levels. So the dislocations are now massive, and I think this is what we're dealing with. And most of my examples are about the United States, but these imbalances here are global in nature. If I did a talk about Europe and the European sovereign debt crisis that is making the headlines now, I don't think any of these imbalances would be any different. In fact, these are the same imbalances we're facing in Japan. And these are the same imbalances which are right now accumulating massively in China. My outlook on China is not a very bullish one. I do think there are massive imbalances in China. China is presently probably one of the most aggressive money creators, and expanding the balance sheets of its banks aggressively, and is certainly accumulating unsustainable levels of debt. So let's look at these imbalances, and I think if we would just step back and look at the design of our monetary system from an Austrian point of view, from the Austrian business cycle theory point of view, and we look at our present monetary system, our fiat money system, these would be exactly the imbalances that we would identify. A system in which banks are never required to contract, in which bank defaults and bank runs are supposed to be a thing of the past, where banks have a lender of last resort, a central bank with unlimited resources, with the ability to create bank reserves to an unlimited degree. That defines our monetary system. It is clear that these banks must become big, and that the banking industry must become ever more bloated. And around the world now, banks have a massive share in GDP everywhere around the world. And it's clear that sort of ever more debt levels must accumulate. If you just look at the last 10 years before this present crisis started, so if you look at the time from 1997 to 2007, over this period, the outstanding amount of mortgage debt in the United States more than tripled, from about $4.8 trillion to about $13.5 trillion US dollars. So there was a massive expansion of debt. I mean, bank balance sheets more than doubled over this period. And if you look at distorted asset markets, there's another good US example. Over the 10 years from 1997 to 2007, house prices in the US grew three times faster than in the previous 100 years. And this is, so much for the point about, there not being any inflation. I think one of the problems why this house of cards was erected so aggressively in the 80s, 90s, in the early part of this century, is simply because all the focus on inflation was on consumer price inflation. But since the early 80s in particular, the credit expansion and expansion of the fiat money base predominantly allowed a rise in asset prices. We had massive boosts to equity prices, and in particular since the 1990s, real estate prices and also fixed income markets benefited from this. So to what degree these markets are distorted, nobody can say. I think there is a reasonable assumption that we have even accumulated more imbalances than I can even list here. Nobody can quantify them. There is no way we can identify what is sustainable debt and what is unsustainable debt. The only mechanism that can tell us what is sustainable or balanced would be to stop printing money and let the market set interest rates, have the available pool of savings determine how much investment and how much capital we can build. And then we will see where the chips fall, and we can see then what the market can sustain. But this is not the system we live in. We live in a system in which the level of interest rates, the extent of bank lending, and money and credit creation by banks is inherently an administrative decision by the central bankers who control the money machine at the core of this. So I think after 40 years of the system, numerous prices are distorted, and I think unfortunately economic activity has been distorted in numerous ways, and we will only ever find out if we stop this printing of money and if we allow a true market to function again. So it's clear, if I call these the imbalances, it's very clear that sort of the market forces are now pointing towards the dissolution of these imbalances. If we stopped any kind of market intervention, I think the market would adjust these imbalances. I mean, if we have too much debt, if the real income streams in the economy cannot sustain the amount of outstanding debt, it is clear that a free market would dissolve these debt levels, and probably in a rather harsh way. I mean, we would see more defaults, we would see debt deflation, and default is not the end of the world. It's just the acknowledgement that the borrower has borrowed too much and the lender has lent too much, and both take a hit, and it will be more difficult for the borrower to borrow again, and the lender will get hurt because his decision was obviously wrong. But it's a natural part of a capitalist system. But now these debt levels have become so big that I think policy does not want to allow this correction. And so and the same is true with the banks. I mean, I do think that the banking industry is entirely bloated, it's way too big, it's built for a never-ending credit boom. But now that this process of ever more credit expansion has reached its limits, these banks the banking sector needs to shrink, and if need be, even via defaults. But no bank is allowed to fail. And this will, therefore policy is standing itself against it. There are two ways in which policy can do this. One is obviously for the government to take that debt on its own balance sheet. And that's part of what we've seen after 2008. We've seen it in Europe and we've seen it in the United States. So you shift private debt to public debt. And that has happened with the nationalization of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. It has happened with, General Motors. It has happened with many other, institutions. It has happened in Europe as well. I mean, Ireland basically bankrupted itself by supporting all its banks and taking the bank debt, onto the government's balance sheet. But the second part of that process is the central banks. Central banks not only lower interest rates and, again, allow the banks to fund themselves at very low interest rates, the central banks have also come to take positions on their own balance sheets. The first round of quantitative easing by the U.S. Fed was clearly aimed at, taking these positions off the banking system, freeing up the capital from the banks, and in particular, stopping the banks from selling these assets and thereby revealing what little private demand there really is for these assets. So another attempt that was made was to stabilize these asset prices. A correction in asset prices, an adjustment in asset prices, was not deemed acceptable by the policymakers. And again, look at the second round of quantitative easing by the Fed, which was clearly targeted at depressing long-term interest rates and boosting the prices of U.S. treasuries. We see a similar policy in Europe, where the ECB has acquired about 160 billion euros of government debt simply to stop the prices of Italian, Spanish, Greek, Portuguese, and Irish bonds to fall further in market. So policy stemming itself against it, and it's very clear to me that I think we also now reached pretty much the limit of these policies, because it's ever more difficult for the governments to take these debts on. Government budget deficits have exploded. Government debt is at record levels. So the problem in the system is, if you take it to the logical conclusion, is the last man standing, the last line of defense, is practically the printing press, which is that also the central banks must not only support the banks and certain asset markets, but must by themselves support the government and support the prices of government bonds in the market and help fund excessive government borrowing. And that is again part, I think, of what we already saw with QE2 in the United States. It's part of what we're seeing in Europe, where the ECB has propped up these asset markets. It's part of what we've seen for a long time in Japan, in that in Japan we had the the Bank of Japan buying JGBs, but more importantly, encouraging the very bloated Japanese banking industry in exchanging private loans for JGBs. And most of the JGBs obviously have now been accumulated on bank balance sheet, funded at zero cost, you know, by the Bank of Japan. Something similar is now going on in the UK, where for months, you know, almost all issuance by the UK government has been placed directly with the banking sector, which in turn is getting funded at 50 basis points at the Bank of England, and therefore, you know, supporting you know, government spending. So this is part of what we're seeing here. This is part of the process. And let me just maybe see. There is a question coming up. I will deal with that in a second. Let me just in order to summarize this, how I see these two positions. You know, we have the Austrian position, which is also my position, and we have the mainstream position, which defines the debate in the media among most economists. But importantly, the mainstream position is also the position, really, of the policymakers. The Austrian perspective is obviously there's no means of avoiding the final collapse of the boom brought about by credit expansion. And the alternative is only whether the crisis should come sooner as the result of voluntary abandonment of further credit expansion, or later as a final and total catastrophe of the currency system involved. That's what Ludwig von Mises wrote in 1949. I think that sums up the choice we're facing right now, Jan. These dislocations will ultimately resolve. I mean, there is no question the market will ultimately win. But the question is, do we allow this voluntarily to unfold? It will be very painful. And, you know, companies will go under. You know, banks will have to be liquidated. You know, maybe pension funds go under. We should see sovereign defaults. You know, the Greek default is basically a done deal. I think other sovereigns will struggle to fund themselves, you know, without, you know, the printing press in the future. So I think if we allow the correction, it will be difficult, it will be painful, but it's inevitable. It is really, as the Austrians said, once you allow this massive credit boom, and we had a 40-year boom, you know, you need to allow that to happen. But this is really the position of the mainstream. You know, this is what Ben Bernanke said in a speech in 2002, before he became the chairman of the Federal Reserve. The U.S. government has a technology called a printing press, or today, its electronic equivalent, that allows it to produce as many U.S. dollars as it wishes at essentially no cost. We conclude that under a paper money system, a determined government can always generate higher spending and hence positive inflation. Now, here comes in the big concern about deflation. You know, deflation is the big evil, according to the mainstream. I would agree that a deflationary correction right now would be very unpleasant, but I would say it is inevitable. It's now, you know, we got ourselves into this position, and there's no other way out of it in allowing this deflationary correction to occur. But the mainstream, and Bernanke is a good spokesman for the mainstream, you know, his position is we have to avoid this deflation with any cost. And we always can create inflation. We always can create nominal spending. We just print more money, and we can do this without limit. So I think these are the two opposing factors here before I come to the next point, contraction versus expansion, let me answer quickly the question that popped up here. The question is the following from David. Is the Japanese economy has been depressed for 20 years. To what extent has that been driven by excessive fiat money, easy credit, etc.? And what conclusions are there for other advanced economies? That's a very good question. I think the reason Japan is in these problems, has these problems, are exactly the same reasons I just explained for the U.S. It's the same driver. It's a very extensive paper money cycle, a very extended, artificially ever more drawn out boom that led to these extreme balance sheet positions in Japan. Remember, in the late 80s, the biggest banks in the world were all Japanese. And Japan went through this massive real estate boom long before the US did. And this whole thing popped in 1989, and then Japan went into these recessions. Now, Japan has been in this position of arrested collapse for 20 years. So what happened is you have on the one side the forces of contraction, as you can also see from my next slide. if we went back to laissez-faire, if we stopped any interventionist policies, no central banks, we went back to an inelastic money supply, you know, a gold standard, and we stopped any interference from the government and any money printing, which is really what I believe we should do. But if you did this, it's very clear that the system would correct. So the market forces are pointing towards a deflationary correction. I'm not quite sure how much consumer prices would deflate. It's very difficult to say, but it's very clear that certain asset prices would adjust, and it's probably clear that the banking sector would shrink, and if that is the case, it's also clear that the supply of money would shrink, and in that environment, you would probably go through a deflationary period. But some of the excess debt will be washed out of the system via defaults. Now, if that were allowed to happen in Japan, we would have that correction. And indeed, it was the unwillingness by the policymakers in Japan to go through that position, that through this process, that led them to support the system with zero interest rates. And they've been doing this for 20 years. I would say what we see in Japan is no endgame here. This is what we see in Japan is that policymakers have managed to sort of stop this collapse, but without generating another expansion. And I think the imbalances are way too big to cause another expansion in an easy way. But if you look at Japan, this is not a stable situation, because in this environment, obviously, the government outlays are constantly bigger than government receipts. Japan is now, has for years been on this path of fiscal deterioration. It's something that has only just started in the United States. Now, amazingly, Japan has to manage to keep in this position for 20 years. But now Japan is the most indebted country in the world. I mean, it has a debt-to-GDP ratio, according to the IMF, of 220% of GDP. I mean, public debt, government debt to GDP is 220%. That's higher than any other country on the planet. So we have an aging population, a growing economy, but one with a huge overhang of dislocations that have not been solved yet, and we have a constant fiscal deterioration, constant accumulation of debt. So again, the choice that Mises gave for us is still a choice that Japan faces. Either it voluntarily allows a correction at some stage, or it tries to inflate itself out of it at some stage because its debt level gets ever bigger. So Japan is not an end game. I think the message to Western economies is here that you should obviously avoid getting into this position. I also think that other countries like the United States will probably not manage to do what Japan did in keeping this sort of on a somewhat even keel for such a long period of time. I would be very surprised if such an extended period of superficial stability, if you like, were to be manufactured in the United States. Just quickly to back to the slide here. So we have the forces of contraction, the forces of expansion. My point of view is that policy is pushing towards inflation. Inflation in itself is not a done deal. I have some sympathy with the deflationists here. You could argue that, again, if we leave the market alone, we would get more a deflationary washout of the imbalances rather than any inflation. It's policy that's pointing to inflation. So why is inflation not already higher? I mean, the Fed, since Lehman Brothers, has tripled its balance sheet. Ben Bernanke has, since that date, since August 2008, when Lehman collapsed, Ben Bernanke has created twice as much money as all his predecessors combined. The Fed is now has a balance sheet of about $2.6 trillion. The balance sheet of the Fed is bigger than M1. But a lot of that money just sits at the Fed. Bank deposits sitting at the Fed, and they're not circulating through the economy for two reasons, really. One is that the private lending and borrowing process is subdued. The private sector does not want to borrow, and the private banks don't want to lend, at least not to a sufficient degree. But it's also fair to say that the Fed is paying the bank's interest to keep it at the Fed. So the Fed is even providing an incentive to keep the money at the Fed. Most of this money is targeted at supporting the banks, not at really creating inflation or spending, as Bernanke just said in his in his remark there. But there is obviously a risk that this money will be let go into the system, and then this will lead to inflation. It's also clear that now the pressure is building on the Fed to do something more for growth, because doing what he has been doing so far, or doing what we see in Japan, which is this just a state of arrested collapse, is not sufficient for policymakers. People want more growth. You know, politicians want the system to get started again. So there has already been debate that the Fed could lower or completely stop paying interest on these deposits at the Fed. I think one of the reasons the market was so disappointed last week about Operation Twist was that the Fed did not lower the interest on deposits and did not announce any further quantitative easing measures. So I think what should we expect from policy next? I think the current situation, again, it doesn't satisfy the policymakers, because they want to generate stronger growth again. They don't see all these imbalances that need to clear. They just want to generate more growth. And so therefore, I think that ultimately the Fed will come around and print more money again, lower interest rates on the deposits, and at some stage conduct quantitative easing again. I think another reason why I'm confident that this will happen is also simply that we are now at a point where the Fed and other central banks are underwriting so many of these dislocations, so many of these positions in the market, these distortions, so many parts of the economy and the financial system depend now on cheap funding from the central bank, that the central bank is in no position to withdraw any of that support, and that is constantly asked to add more to it. I jump two slides further here. I think one of the key points for me in this evolving crisis is really, at what point would the public lose confidence in this, very unstable system? From my description, you can see that, we're dealing with something here that can tip over at any moment. And I think the key point also for rising inflation and for loss of confidence in the monetary unit, I think this is the key question, because this is ultimately what leads to higher inflation. It's not just the number of outstanding dollar units or the size of M2 or M1. I mean, as I said before, the monetary base has exploded since this financial crisis. It's three times bigger than it was 3 years ago. Over the last year, M2 has probably expanded by 10%. So we do have enough already in terms of monetary growth to allow for some rise in the inflation rate. But in order to really cause a loss of faith in the monetary system and in the Fed, I think something else needs to happen. And I think the triggers I could think of is really, if at some stage inflation creeps higher and higher, and at some stage the public will demand higher real interest rates as a compensation for higher inflation. But it's very clear that now that the Fed has moved itself into that position of underwriting and supporting the entire system, that the Fed cannot allow higher real interest rates. I mean, that's one thing that the system cannot deal with. So if the concern about inflation gets to such a degree, to such a level, that the market demands higher real interest rates, the Fed will have to become more accommodative and print more money and buy more assets in order to suppress market interest rates again, keep real yields low, because the credit edifice, the shaky credit edifice, cannot deal with higher real interest rates. And a similar trigger would be a realization that the public debt is out of control. And again, that's something that has clearly not happened yet. Despite all the concern about the U.S. deficit, the public is still obvious confidence in U.S. Treasuries. Just simply look at 10-year U.S. Treasuries traded below 2% in yield for weeks now, trading slightly above. But there's obviously still tremendous confidence in the U.S. government to pay and to service its debt. If that were to get shaken at some point, the market again would immediately demand higher real yields. And then what would the central bank do? It cannot allow the Treasury market to tank and yields to shoot up. It would pull the rug from under all these overextended banks and asset markets. So in a way, if you look at the situation in Europe, where what I just described happened to countries like Greece or to countries like Ireland or Portugal, or is about to happen to a country like Italy, you know, that's a moment when the central bank needs to step in and buy these bonds in order to keep yields low, because nobody can cope with higher real yields. But in a situation in which the market is dumping these bonds and the central bank is buying them at an ever faster pace, things can quickly spin out of control. I'm of the view that even if the Greek central bank, if the Greeks get their own central bank now and their own currency, as some people say they should, imagine Greece now had its own central bank, its own currency. You know, if the market has no confidence in its government bonds, it would sell the government bonds, the Greek central bank would be on the other side buying them ever faster. That would immediately undermine its currency, and people would immediately have concern about rising inflation, dump the currency, dump the government bonds even faster. And once you get into such a cycle, things spin out of control. And the third trigger I could see that would ultimately triple things over is another massive policy initiative. You know, what if the economy stays very weak, unemployment rises, you know, we go through another, you know, statistical recession for the next year or so, and then at some point policymakers feel like they have to really pull out all the stops, and the Fed becomes much more aggressive, expands the balance sheet by another trillion or 1.5 trillion, is there a point in which the public would lose confidence? Of all these three triggers, I personally think that the second one is the one I'm most concerned about. I do think the one variable I'm watching very, very closely is how the market deals the so-called safe haven government bonds right now. It's U.S. Treasuries, German bonds, and also JGBs in Japan. Three, you know, major countries issuing government bonds. They all have their own debt problems already. I mean, they're all, none of these countries is fiscally sound and fiscally stable. And in Japan is obviously in the worst position. But things are deteriorating very quickly for the United States government, which is now running $1.5 trillion deficits every year. In Germany, the situation is slightly better. But as we saw yesterday and today, Germany is now being asked to take on financial markets as itself, you know, what I described earlier with the government taking stuff on its own balance sheet. That's what happened in Germany, where Germany is now being asked by its European partners to take on, to join a fiscal union and to support these bailout funds, and they're basically underwrite Italian debt or Greek debt, with money from the German taxpayer. So again, you see all these governments are under attack. But so far, none of this has led to these government bonds losing their status as safe havens. But if that were to happen, if the market would shun these bonds and begin to sell them, the yields on these bonds go up, and that means that immediately the central banks would have to step in, or otherwise, you know, the unraveling of this credit edifice would be unstoppable in my view. Before I go to the next slide or the previous slide, let me just have a quick look, because a couple of questions have been accumulating here, and maybe I should just answer them right now. Well, the one question here from Joe is, doesn't Japan have a larger amount of savings than the U.S. that could cushion the blow there? I think yes and no. I think that is a very good point in explaining one thing. I said before, Japan managed to stay in this, to maintain the state of arrested collapse of its system for 20 years. And I did say that I don't think this will be possible in the United States. And the reason for that difference is exactly your point, Joe. Japan historically had a higher savings rate. Japan was a high saving country. So when they went from a boom into a bust, and the government accumulated all these, you know, this debt, and did basically what the U.S. government did, and ran this huge deficit, and was running these deficits to this day. Not all of that had to be funded by the central bank or by other central banks, as is the case with the U.S. deficit, but a lot of that was funded for a long time by Japanese savings. So in a way, the Japanese consumed less than they produced, they saved the difference, and they handed it to their government, which, you know, wasted the money right away to on stimulus programs, which have now, you know, run their course, and they didn't stimulate a lot, but the money has basically been spent. And the government is left with a deficit, and the Japanese saver is holding these JGBs. And so for a long time, the Japanese were saving. But I think this process is now coming to an end. The saving rate in Japan has dropped very, very sharply in recent years. I mean, for various factors. I mean, one driver behind this is also the rapid aging of the Japanese population. Demographically, Japan is in a very difficult position. It's rapidly aging population. Now, look at all these aging Japanese now, what they hold as assets, as saving assets, as pension assets to, for their savings, are all these, you know, JGBs, these government bonds. But they're not backed by anything. They don't represent productive capital. There are no companies behind it. So yes, on a statistical account, from a statistical accounting point of view, you can speak of savings and assets. But if you look deeper, a lot of these are just government bonds, and the underlying capital has been wasted. You know, the Japanese built roads to nowhere. You know, or there are lots of public pools, you know, as various programs, infrastructure programs, to stimulate the economy. That's where the money has gone. But this is not sufficient to feed, you know, the Japanese pensioners when they retire. So the saving rate has dropped massively. Saving has allowed Japan to sustain this madness for longer. But it's now, the saving rate has now dropped. And as the population ages, unfortunately, they look at a pension scheme that is not backed by assets, but by promises from politicians. Terry's question is, if GDP is measured by the transaction of dollars, then isn't the revelation of GDP growth really just measuring inflation, just proving CPI is a false measure? Let me think about that. I need to see if I understand your question, Terry. Well, if I understand your question correctly, I mean, I do think that, I mean, you're talking about in measuring GDP, are we not measuring, is not distorted by inflation? I mean, if I understand your question correctly, obviously, you know, most GDP statistics try to adjust for that, and providing an inflation-adjusted GDP or real GDP number rather than a nominal GDP number. Now, we can have a debate on whether that adjustment is correct. I mean, the way the government calculates inflation now, or the official inflation statistics, that process has changed numerous times. There's a huge debate out there, you know, how reliable inflation data is. And I think, if I understand your question correctly, I think I agree with you that if inflation is not correctly calculated, then it will also distort the measurement of GDP. But overall, you know, for me personally, I try to stay away from a lot of these statistical debates, because you move onto the ground of the macroeconomic mainstream, which is obsessed with these statistics. And, you know, when is there a technical recession, and what is the GDP, has the GDP growth been last year? You know, all these things are very difficult to measure. But it's very clear that in an economy that, like ours, in which the share of government spending is substantial. I mean, even in the United States, where historically it used to be low, but if we add state and municipal spending with federal spending, we are also now very close to, 50% of the government of GDP is driven by public sector spending. Then it becomes very difficult to really look at GDP as a meaningful statistic to begin with. You know, in China, for example, right now, the GDP statistic looks so strong, partially because of credit-funded public sector programs, where big roads are being built, entire cities are being built in China. Often, the motivation is entirely political. These are political projects, funded by state-owned banks or state-controlled banks, which get cheap credit. And while these projects are being implemented, statistically they boost GDP, but do they really fulfill any needs? Is there really a private demand for this? Is this really a sensible use of resources, or is it just waste? You know, we can't tell. Without a proper market, you can't tell. So I'm very skeptical of any of these GDP statistics. Tony's question is, how does the Fed reabsorb all of the liquidity they have given the banks? And what would be the unintended consequences of that? Well, if the Fed wanted to recollect the liquidity they've given to the banks, I mean, right now, since Lehman Brothers, the Fed has injected around $1.7 trillion of fresh money into the system. And again, a lot of that money is not reaching the people in the street. A lot of that money sits in the financial system, you know, with the banks. So how could the Fed get that money back from the banks? Well, it would be very simple, because the Fed has obviously the assets. You know, whenever the Fed injects liquidity into the banks, it buys assets from the banks. So in the first round of quantitative easing, the Fed acquired about $1 trillion portfolio of mortgages from the banking sector, taking the mortgages off the banks, putting it on the Fed's balance sheet, and the accounting, you know, the bookkeeping exercise on the other side was to credit the bank's accounts at the Fed with newly printed money. And so the Fed buys assets and it pays for these assets by printing new money, bank reserve money, and just, it's an accounting process. Ben Bernanke just has to press a button and $1 trillion appears as new money, deposit money for the banks. If they want to reverse that process, they would just have to sell the mortgages back to the banks and then wipe out the money that they created 3 years ago when they bought the mortgages. They could do the same with the treasuries. They could sell all these assets into the market. But if the Fed now sold $1.7 trillion of assets into the market, I mean, they would sell $1 trillion mortgages, it would certainly depress the mortgage market. It would certainly cause mortgage spreads to widen. It would, that these assets need to be then supported by the banks or investment managers or pension funds. Somebody needs to buy these assets. And it's clear to me there is no market for these assets. I correct that. There would probably be a market, but at prices that the Fed does not want to see, and it would constrain the bank's ability to create more credit, which is also something that the Fed doesn't want to do. So technically, it would be an easy process, but nobody wants it, because all the discussion is about doing another round of quantitative easing and injecting even more money into the system. The question from Zach is, what do you think of a scenario of stable treasury and interest rates due to the Fed covering all government debt issues while prices go through the roof? So what do you think of the scenario of stable treasury and interest rates, the Fed covering all government? So I think this is what I would call the total liquidation strategy. You know, the Fed underwrites everything. And you can argue even that in such a scenario, theoretically at least, you could build a scenario in which treasuries are basically turned into paper money. If you look at it, what is a piece of paper? You know, what is paper money or even a bank deposit right now, where it's a paper note, a dollar bill is an irredeemable piece of paper. You know, you get nothing. I mean, you can exchange it in the marketplace. You can buy stuff with it as long as people take it, but you cannot take it to the government or to the central bank and get gold, as you used to be able to do. That was the gold standard, when now it's an irredeemable piece of paper. But it also means it will never be repaid for anything. There's no maturity on it. It is just irredeemable. And in a way, you know, you can look at a treasury security as being the same thing. You know, if you assume that the U.S. government will never repay its debt, so whenever any of these bonds expire, a new one will just be issued. So again, they are irredeemable pieces of paper. And if the Fed were, as you suggested in your question, Zach, if the Fed were to underwrite completely all treasury securities and say, like, whenever you have a treasury security, you, the public, you can take it to the Fed, and the Fed will immediately exchange it for freshly printed treasury bills at face value. You know, in such an environment, U.S. treasury securities would be indistinguishable from U.S. Banknotes, from dollar banknotes. And in such a scenario, in such an extreme scenario of, you know, total monetization of the treasury debt, you could argue that, you know, the yield on these treasuries should be zero, because the yield on U.S. banknotes is zero. So I think this is the scenario you described. And I think this is theoretically possible. I think if that were to happen, I think the purchasing power of that paper dollar and those treasury notes would suffer. Because, I mean, at that point, it's very clear that I think that would undermine the acceptance of these banknotes. And we would definitely see, you know, rapidly rising inflation. So I think yes, this is possible, what you described. but I think it must have an impact on how this money is being traded for real goods and services. In such an environment, I would definitely want to be long gold. What do you think of healthier countries such as Norway? I am not an expert on countries like Norway or some other. I mean, I give you my thoughts. I mean, I think Norway is in a very good position, obviously, not because it's running such a smarter policy, there's better politicians, but simply because it's sitting on lots of oil, and therefore it you know, even has a fairly general, fairly left-leaning, you know, political process, but it's sitting on so much natural resources that it doesn't have a lot of these problems. I think it's sensible to look for places like those to park some of your money. I mean, I think if the question behind this is a little bit like, you know, what should we do with our money? And I think in places like the United States, in places like Europe, like the country I'm from, Germany, for example, or the country I live in right now, which is the UK, you know, all these places have similar problems. And I think if you have wealth, if you have private wealth, you have to be concerned, because you know that these governments are running out of money, and the only choice they have is either they default on it, which would be the honest thing to do, but we all know that it's also the last thing they want to do. And they all have this constant temptation to use the printing press, which certainly, you know, is going to destroy your wealth. I also would like to say that I think one of the key risks I see in our current crisis is the introduction of capital controls. I go back one slide here in my presentation. I speak of paper money's endgame, which is the final chapter of my book. And these are three key steps in the process of disintegration of a fiat money system. You reach the point of what I call the nationalization of money and credit. And we already see it in all these countries. Part of that is that the central bank becomes the lender of last resort, and in fact, the lender of only resort. The only entity that's really lending and really pushing credit into the system is the central bank, and is using the printing press. And on the other side, most of the borrowing now occurs by the public sector. That's the case in the United States, that is the case in Europe. We see it in Japan with a massive accumulation of public debt. So already the credit creation process has moved from a private sector process to one where the lender is the central bank and the borrower is the state. But what I mean by that also is the nationalization of money and credit. You know, these activities need to be seconded by other interventions, among them capital controls. You know, I think that we will see more legislation that will force pension funds, insurance companies, and banks into buying government securities. Already this is happening. We see, banking regulation around the world. I mean, the one asset that most banks can buy, you know, most easily with the least capital costs is always government bonds. And that's one of the reasons why in the European debt crisis, all these banks sit on massive amounts of Greek, Italian, Spanish government bonds, and German government bonds for that matter, because they that's the easiest way they can lend. So already we see ever more interference with the market. So coming back to your Norway question, I think if you hold wealth, you have to be very concerned. And one of the questions for everybody is where to put it. Now, places like Norway are definitely in better shape. Another country I always like is, you know, Switzerland. But in Switzerland, you already see the problem. Couple of weeks ago, on the 6th of September, the Swiss National Bank decided that it would no longer allow the Swiss franc to appreciate more than beyond a certain level against the euro. So, the Swiss franc had obviously been appreciating on the back of massive capital inflows. I mean, Swiss banks were not paying any interest if you gave them money. If you brought their money to Switzerland and put it on deposit at a Swiss bank, they would not pay you anything. For a while, actually, the interbank lending rates became negative. You basically, banks were paying Swiss banks, were paying them to take their money rather than collecting interest rate on it. And this got to a point where the Swiss felt our currency is appreciating too much, and there was political pressure building in Switzerland And again, you see they're now, the Swiss National Bank is printing lots of money, not for any domestic reasons, but mainly to manage the exchange rate. So what I'm saying is, these smaller countries, some of them are in a better position, but the fundamental problem of paper money systems are also relevant in these countries, and you also run the risk that if their currencies appreciate too much, they either introduce capital controls themselves, or they begin to print money themselves to not have their currency appreciate too sharply. For me personally, I think one of the safest places in this crisis are still precious metals, like gold and silver. I go through some of the other questions here. Mark has a question. You say that central banks cannot tolerate rising real interest rates and will have to intervene by printing money. How long can they keep that up? What defines the end of their ability to keep the lid on real interest rates? Now, ultimately, they will not be able to do this, but this is really how paper money systems collapse. If you look at Argentina in 2002, or look at this most dramatic of examples, the Weimar Republic, Germany in 1923, which for a long time, until at least the 1990s, was the highest rate of inflation ever recorded around the world. It was the big currency collapse of the old Reichsmark in Germany in 1923. And I think this is how it usually happens. The confidence in the currency evaporates. People, when money becomes a hot potato and the government bonds become a hot potato, and when people sell the government bonds, the yields go up, and then the central bank steps in, buys the government bonds, funds the government directly with the printing press, because the government cannot borrow at reasonable interest rates in the marketplace. And so the central bank has to keep printing money. And then a race starts between the private sector trying to get away from the government bonds and the paper money of the state, and the state trying to print ever more and keep interest rates low and keep the government, in business and keep the banks from collapsing. They need to print money ever faster. I think when that race kicks in, I think things unravel fairly quickly. And then that is what Mises described as the total and complete currency catastrophe. So this is not something, keeping real interest rates low is something that you cannot do against market forces for long. And that's why I think, I'll be very clear right now, I think right now policymakers in America are very fortunate, because obviously they stopped quantitative easing round two, they stopped buying these treasury securities, but because the equity market fell out of bed and because of other weak economic data, many investors are still going to US treasuries as a safe haven. So at this stage right now, I think the central bank does not have to worry about treasury yields. If that were the case, I think that is then a sign that you get to the end of the system. This is really how paper money systems ultimately collapse. The next question from Tom is, what would happen if the Fed raised interest rates to, say, 20% in order to contract the economy with some resemblance of control, and then move to a gold standard? Well, I think the Fed would not necessarily have to set rates that high. Rates were that high when Paul Volcker stopped the printing press in 1979 or 1980, about that time. This was the only time since America adopted a pure paper standard and severed any link to gold in 1971. So from 1971 to 2011, in these 40 years, there was only one time in which the Fed really stopped the printing press with any kind of consistency. And it was done by Paul Volcker. At the time, the official inflation rate was already fairly high. So he stopped the printing press and he allowed the market to set interest rates. And in fact, the market did set short interest rates at 20%. So it was not so much that the Fed did it and determined where interest rates should be. This is just stop printing money and allowed the market to decide. If the Fed did that again today, I can't say where interest rates would be, but if they were that high, we would definitely see, obviously, a correction in many asset markets. I think we would certainly see a bank defaults. I think it would mean, a government default. I think the current size of the U.S. government and the current size of the deficit is only sustainable with very low interest rates, low funding costs, and with the funding from central banks. Please remember that for years, the U.S. deficit has practically not been funded by the private sector or American savers, has mainly been funded by central banks. For most of those years, not by the U.S. Fed, but by Asian central banks. I mean, that's why the Bank of China accumulated all these foreign exchange reserves. You know, they matched the Fed's money printing, and they used the they bought all these dollars and bought U.S. Treasuries with them. They've stopped doing this now, and now the Fed has been doing more of it. I think if we go to high real interest rates or if we stop printing money, I think sooner or later it will pull the rug from under these oversized governments. That would be a good thing. I think, you know, it is better to acknowledge that this debt will never be repaid and then shrink the government to a normal measure. I think what we should do is we should stop printing money. We should go back to some form of gold standard. And I think what would that mean to the economy? It would mean that, we go through a very nasty correction. I do think, you know, banks would default, pension funds, some corporations. I think the government would come out and have to say that they cannot meet their commitments, that they have too much debt, and they would have to default on certain things. I think all of that would be painful, but would be necessary and ultimately put the economy on a sound footing. It's very interesting. I explain in my book, I have a chapter on the history of paper money systems. And paper money systems, the first paper money systems were created in China about 1,000 years ago, and then the first Western systems in the late 17th century. Now, all these paper money systems collapsed. You know, they always collapsed. None of them survived. I mean, there's always a point when they come to their end. And they always ended one of two ways. Either the monetary authorities realize that things are unstable, they voluntarily stop printing money, they allow the system to adjust and go back to a commodity standard, or they don't do this and they miss this point, and then it ends in hyperinflation. So what I'm saying is, like, you know, this return to a gold standard, stop printing money, allow the market to set interest rates, cleanse the system of its dislocations, very painful, but then go back to a gold standard. This has been done numerous times. That's been done by the U.S. government. The United States took the dollar off gold in 1861 to fund the Civil War. Most paper money, almost all paper money systems in the world were introduced to fund the government, and most of them were introduced to fund wars. Almost all paper money experiments in history, you know, were around revolutions or wars, because that's when the politicians needed more money, and the constraints, the straitjacket of a gold standard was deemed too tight. So America went off gold in 1861. The greenbacks were issued. America went through a period of inflation. The Civil War ended, and for some time there was a very controversial debate in America about whether, you know, a return to a gold standard should be enacted. It finally was done in 1879. Now, again, this led to deflation. Prices collapsed. The stock of money in the system contracted. Now, it's very interesting that at that point, the U.S. economy did not go through a recession, and in fact continued to grow very nicely, even through a period of deflation. And there's a beautiful chapter in the book by Milton Friedman and Anna Schwartz, the monetary history of the United States. Both of them are obviously not Austrians, and they're certainly not, you know, advocates of the gold standard. They're advocates of central banking. But it's a beautiful passage because they say how amazing it is for them as economic historians to see that here's a period where we go back from paper money to commodity money, we go through a contraction of money supply and a drop in the price level, and yet the economy digests this quite well and continues to grow. To be very fair, I'm not quite sure what would happen today. Nobody can be sure. I don't think it will be quite as smooth this time. I think we would have to go through what we would have to call a crisis. You know, there would be pain, and companies would go under, and banks would go under. But again, the Austrian message is that is baked in the cake anyway. That is definitely going to happen. There is no way you can avoid this. The only thing that politicians can do or will try and do is postpone the day of reckoning ever further. And as they do this, they will make the final collapse even harder. Yeah, that's the message from Mises and the quote I gave you. And I think that sums it up perfectly. You know, it's either you go to take that pain now or you take more pain later. But unfortunately, there is this attitude of not on my watch. And I'll tell you another thing, another reason for why I think that ultimately the central banks will print more money, will monetize state debt, will even fund the government with a printing press. It will happen in the Fed, it will happen with the ECB in Europe, is simply because the dislocations are now so big that politically, you know, nobody thinks it's really acceptable to put the electorate through such a process. I think since 2008, since Lehman Brothers, we know that any meaningful correction of the system is now deemed politically unacceptable. So here is another question from Paul. Assuming a fiat money collapse, is gold currently undervalued, and would one find some asset protection with metal ETFs such as GLD? In general, how would equities and fixed income respond to a fiat money collapse to the extent you have a view? So I hope you understood the question. Let me repeat it just quickly again. Assuming a fiat money collapse, is gold currently undervalued, and would one find some protection with metal ETFs such as GLD? In general, how would equities and fixed income respond to a fiat money collapse? I think gold is the essential self-defense asset. I'm a big fan of it. I think it's cheap right now. I mean, it's trading in the low 1600s. The way I see things going, I cannot much see beyond gold. I do think it's the number one self-defense asset. Maybe silver as well, and I know many people look at other things, I don't know, like farmland, arable land, forestry. I'm no expert in any of these. I don't have the means and I don't have the expertise to really be involved. Maybe I should educate myself, but I think gold is, for me, is the number one asset. My concern is not so much that the gold price goes down. I think it can go down for various reasons, technical reasons, or, I mean, what we've seen over the last week, like general liquidation of positions, which then also affects gold. But I think in any paper money crisis, gold is being rediscovered as the eternal form of money. You know, Alan Greenspan himself said it in a testimony in U.S. Congress, I think it was in 1999, I'm sure I can dig up that quote. He said it in testimony. He said, in extremis, nobody will accept fiat money. Gold will always be accepted. And I think that's right. So I do think, for me, it is gold. I still believe in it. I think at current levels it's cheap. The number one concern is obviously confiscation and taxation and these kind of things. I mean, as you all know, Roosevelt in April 1933, per executive order, confiscated all privately held gold in the United States. And although the executive order expired, American citizens were not allowed to invest in gold privately until 1974. So I think, again, you know, the question becomes, should you hold gold, then in what form should you hold it, where should you hold it? And there are huge debates about, you know, people who invest like I do about these things, and many people disagree. So this would be a too long a conversation. But yes, I think it's gold. I personally don't like ETFs. I like the physical gold. The whole idea is that you have control yourself over it. With the ETF, you need to be careful how much of it is really physically backed. Different ETFs are structured differently. You need to look at the prospectus. You look at all these details. For me personally, I think that's not what I like to do. When I want to hold gold, I want to hold it in physical form. I'm not saying that all these ETFs are schemes. I would not say that. Maybe there are some good ones there. There are certain ones where you can even ask for the physical delivery of the gold. But I don't see the point, because, you know, the ETF is nice because you can trade in and out. But I don't use my gold investment to trade in and out. Gold is something, as Doug Casey says, that you accumulate, and you accumulate in quantity. So you buy it on the corrections, but it's not like to trade in and out of. How would equities and fixed income respond to a paper money crisis? It's very interesting. I think historically, from what I know, I'm not a historian, but it makes also sense to me as an economist, is that in the run-up to a paper money crisis, as the economy, you know, has these, you know, growing imbalances and it's not growing properly, and policy gets ever more desperate, you see a strong underperformance of equities, and equities do very poorly. In the crisis, when confidence in the state and paper money is finally undermined, when you know, when really the fiat money crisis sets in, then equities tend to do better again. And obviously, then gold does very well. But I know in some of these instances, even equities do pretty well. Remember that you know many companies, those companies that survived the crisis, you know, are the ones that still have you know solid products. They have assets. They have something to use and to be active with. You know, once you come out of the crisis. There are real assets backing it, and productive assets, productive capital. So in that sense, I think in the crisis, equity should do better. It's fixed income that should be the problem. And again, that's an indication for me, what we've seen over the summer and over the last couple of weeks, the sharp sell-off in equities and the rally in fixed income, particularly government bonds, tells me that the market right now is not trading the paper money collapse scenario. I think it will come. I don't see another solution, but I think that right now equities could be under pressure. In the long run, I'm not so negative on equities. I think there could be well-managed companies, you know, with good products that make it through the crisis. And if you come out at the other end, you know, we're not going to go back to some Mad Max scenario of no civilization. You know, societies go through these crises, but they come out at the other end. And then you rather want to be invested in a real company. Also, please remember that in a fiat money crisis, there is what Mises called a crack up boom, when people try to get rid of their cash and buy whatever they can get their hands on. And that would potentially also include your shares in companies. So equities do poorly in the run up to the crisis, and the crisis they do better. I think gold is my number one self-defense asset. Fixed income is the one I'm most concerned about. There's a question by Susan. If the Fed can keep interest rates artificially low, there must be a free market standard. This is measured against which means even the central bank are subject to free market forces. If the free market naturally wants sound money, it is only a matter of time, I guess, that's missing here. So, Susan, sorry, let me see if I understand your question correctly. So if I so the first question is, I mean, so Susan's question is, well, if the Fed keeps interest rates artificially low, I mean, if I understand you correctly, Susan, the question is like, against what standard do you measure that artificially low against what? Now, I would say that if you have no central bank and if you have a proper commodity money system, interest rates are mainly originary interest rates, according to Mises, reflect time preference. But you know, in a context of a loan market, I would say they reflect the available of true voluntary savings. You know, the extent to which resources have been freed up from their use in present consumption and been made available for investment projects and can form a capital stock. And that is the interest rate. So the interest rate that would be true saving, the propensity to save, sets a certain interest rate. And that can be artificially lowered on the market by injecting more money into it. So then the other question is really, the central bank is ultimately also subject to market forces. Well, that is true, but remember the central bank has no limit on how it prints money. So the market forces come in. If the central bank suppresses interest rates below what would be justified by savings, and then you create the extra investment, but there's not backed by savings. So ultimately, that leads to a correction. When the correction occurs, the central bank prints more money and again stops interest rates from moving back up and keeps them artificially depressed. So in that sense, the central bank can not escape market forces, but it can fight market forces for a very, very long time. Is there a natural trend back to sound money? I think that ultimately is the case. I mean, I think the problem here is simply that just with the normal standard inflation that we experience right now, I think most money users, like all of us, can still deal with that inflation. I mean, you can, the public is so used to the established form of money. it's very costly for society to disengage from the established form of money. I think that's one of the reasons why it's so compelling for paper money producers to produce ever more money, because you can do this for a long time until you undermine confidence by the public. I think this is one of the problems with Hayek's suggestion from the 1970s. Friedrich Hayek suggested a denationalization of money and currency competition. But one of the problems here is clearly that, you know, once people are used to one form of money, they don't want to have competing currencies around. It's much easier to have one form of money. And if it inflates all the time, people can cope with this. I mean, from 1971, when Nixon closed the gold window, to 2011, the US dollar has lost 82% of its purchasing power. And yet the American public has accommodated to this. You know, they're holding much larger, you know, stacks of dollars now in their pockets to have the same purchasing power, because all these dollar bills have been produced. But they're not disengaging from this paper money. So what I'm saying is, like, the market forces are not in such a form that, you know, any inflation will immediately lead to the market switching to another form of money. It's only at hyperinflation. So you need to push this to an extreme point, and then the market will disengage. And then I do think the market will ask for some money again. One point here about the Norwegian policy is to hold stable exchange rates in relation to the dollar, and additionally the oil fund is directly connected to government bonds and stocks. It looks really bad over here too. So I think this is coming from Norway. Yeah, I think that is a good point about, I think it goes in line with what I said about Switzerland. You see, even you have countries like Norway and Switzerland, which from the domestic levels, from the domestic makeup, that could probably provide superior forms of money. But for whatever reason, you know, that the, you know, again, fiat money is always a political tool. You know, there is no such an idea of like neutral money, and certainly not apolitical money. If it's paper money, it's created by the central bank, it will ultimately be used to achieve political objectives. That's the case in Switzerland, as we've seen a few weeks ago. It was blatantly an attempt to help the export industry, which has political clout. There may be other reasons in Norway why, the Norwegian kroner is pegged to the dollar. It is a tool for politics. You know, every form of paper money is a tool for politics. So here's another question from Zach. Where can you get figures of general bank industry debt levels, apart from looking at individual balance sheets? It's a good question. I, to be honest, I asked a friend of mine who is a credit analyst in London. He sent me a big spreadsheet on bank asset levels, and I think that is data actually from the Fed. I do think the Fed may have some statistics on aggregate levels of bank balance sheets, but I'm not very, very good on that. Michael's question, you mentioned in a blog post that gold, silver is still a good investment in a deflationary environment. Could you explain the reason for this? Well, what I mean by this is, if I look at, I think the two things I look at right now a lot is, I have this slide here in my presentation where I ask the question where government bonds are there at the shore of the century. I think at some stage there will be. I mean, it's ridiculous, the deficits that some of these governments are running. And the deficit, the debt they're accumulating is mind-blowing, it's staggering. And there is no intention, no ability to ever repay this. And this is, in some cases, firmly out of control. And yet the market still seems to trade these as safe haven assets with very low yields. So I think there is an opportunity. And but I think the thought behind shorting government bonds is that you win in both cases, in a deflationary and inflationary environment. Because as we said earlier, if they stop the printing press and go back to a gold standard, the government cannot pay for its expenses, you know, not out of tax revenue. They would have to probably default, and then you lose on your government bonds. And if they try to inflate the system and create hyperinflation, you also lose on your government bonds. So it's a lose-lose situation, ultimately, it seems to me. In both extreme situations, you lose on government bonds. Now I come to your question, Michael, which is on gold and silver. Gold and silver always seem to be win-win in both scenarios. I mean, certainly in inflation, that's straightforward. As I said before, in a paper money crisis, gold becomes your ultimate self-defense asset. But now imagine deflation. We stop the printing press. you know, we allow the system to correct. The privileged money producers were the banks and the state. They are both bloated now. They will contract, and some of them will default. So, you know, holding your money in bank deposits, and that's where most of the money sits, you know, that's becoming dangerous. Now, government bonds used to be like a place to park it. You can't do that either in a deflation environment. They are lose-lose, as we just said. So, you know, you can obviously put it in productive assets and equities and so forth, but that's a proper investment. That's not parking your cash. So I do think, again, in that environment, maybe gold would not appreciate as much as in the inflationary environment, but I don't think a deflationary environment would undermine it completely. And if you go back to a gold standard, I mean, gold would definitely be attractive. If you go back to some official gold standard in which the government sets a new price for gold that would then cover, let's say, M1 or something, that would certainly be at a much higher price than the gold price is today. I think the U.S. Government officially holds about 260 million ounces of gold. At the current market price, that's about $480 billion market value. Let's make it easier and say we go back to $2,000 per ounce in the market price. That would mean the U.S. government's gold holdings are worth $500 billion. Now, that is, of course, not enough to cover the current amount of M1 or the Fed's balance sheet. The current M1 is less than M1 is, I mean, I have to probably guess now, 2.2 trillion or something. So in order to cover that, we're talking more of a gold price of, you know, $10,000. So what I'm saying is, if we go back to an official gold standard and deflation by an official gold standard, you win anyway with gold. If you just go back to not printing money and deflation, I think gold will still do okay. And if you go into hyperinflation, you definitely win with gold. So I think it works. Adrian, what do you think about commentators that suggest QE3 has already begun? Just hasn't officially been announced yet. Is this true? Wouldn't it explain the lower interest rates in U.S. Treasuries? No, I don't think QE3 has officially started. I think we have to look at the Fed's balance sheet. I think the measure, the quantitative easing, you can see very easily. There is a there is a page on the I think it's the St. Louis Fed that has a page on the on the monetary base and bank reserves in the United States, updated every month. It goes back to 1918, so you can nicely see the entire, you know, history of the U.S. Fed. It's updated every month, and you can see exactly how that position has changed, and you can see very neatly if quantitative easing in its proper form occurred. I do think what some of these commentators mean is the following. The Fed has pretty much promised that they keep rates at 0%. Now, if for some reason market conditions cause an upward drift in money market yields, then the Fed would have to, in order to keep its promise to keep, you know, the rates near zero, would have to expand its balance sheet and buy more assets. There is a chance that right now there is so much liquidity in the money market that right now they would not have to do that, that rates will stay close to zero even without them buying more assets. But I think there is a chance that if yields drift higher for whatever reason, then the Fed would have to come out and buy more assets. So now implicitly QE3 has not started, but their commitment to keep rates low may ultimately force them to do something similar to QE3. Tom says the U.S. government has large assets in which to sell, and if they're sold slowly, then we would not default. It's a good question. I mean, what is outstanding debt right now? I mean, is it officially 10 trillion or something? So I don't know. I mean, how many assets were like the national parks and, you know, the highway system? You know, I could say there are lots of assets, and they could shut down the military and stop the wars and bring all the soldiers home. And the United States has bases in what, 150 different countries. If you bring that all back, I mean, there's so many things, you know, the government could do to raise revenue and sell all sorts of assets and maybe you know, that would help the situation. I can see your point, Tom. I'm not quite sure that it adds up simply for the reason that just looking at the current expenditure, I mean, right now the U.S. government spends about $3.5 trillion every year, and the U.S. government takes in about $2 trillion every year. So you have a $1.5 trillion deficit, or certainly this year. The forecast is for that to shrink because the economy is supposed to do better and some of the spending programs are supposed to run out. But you know, these forecasts have not really worked, and if the economy stays weak, which I expect it will, I think the deficit is just a big problem. So it's not just a stock of debt that, you know, we can sell assets against and then work off the debt. It's just that the U.S. government is spending money like a drunken sailor, and it's just simply not taking in the revenues. And looking at these projections, I think the deficits are going to go bigger. So I think my concern is more, it's not just a stock of debt, it's just the dynamics behind the U.S. fiscal situation that are so adverse. I can't see how they fix that. But you know, maybe it's an interesting project to see all the stuff they could sell, but I'd be very doubtful. And the current obligations are just massive. I mean, some people, if you really take all the Medicare and Social Security commitments and you put them all on a balance sheet, I mean, some people think this could be 50 trillion or 70 trillion. I mean, we're talking astronomical numbers. Also, you know, another point to remember is like, you know, we're not selling any of these assets in the open market. I don't think the you know, the U.S. government wants to sell the national parks to the Chinese government. That's another thing. It's like, you know, these assets will mainly be sold again to, you know, domestic buyers, and I don't think those are available with attractive money. So I don't think it will be enough. Chart says, in a free market money system, are you in favor of the Hayek model of denationalization? You also mentioned that Mises was in favor of zero fractional reserve lending. Do you think that storage houses and investment banks would arise in such a system? Yes, I do think that I think we should have entirely a free market. I don't want the government any involvement in finance and in money. Not even create a gold standard, have no central bank, let the market decide. I think in such a system, I could see gold storage houses or then, you know, banks. I mean, this was what banks were originally like. I mean, they stored the gold and then created a payment system on the basis of a stored gold. And I think today, in the world of the internet and payment, modern payment technology, you could create a very well-functioning global payment system on the basis of a couple of gold hoards where the gold is stored, but then you can transfer ownership in it, you know, fairly easily electronically. I mean, there are various schemes. I don't even know how it would work exactly. I would want the market to decide what to do. I think yes, it would evolve as a private market system. That would be the preferred solution for me. I think that's a little bit the problem I have with Mises' suggestion of zero fractional reserve banking, because if I want the government to be not involved, the government should also not ban or restrict fractional reserve banking. It should be, if people want to run a fractional reserve bank, they should be allowed to do it. And so I suspect in a completely free market, there would be fractional reserve banking. And yes, Mises is right, that would probably initiate some business cycles. You would probably have a certain degree of economic volatility in such a system. I'm not saying it would be perfect. I don't think there's any monetary system that's entirely perfect. But I don't want to ban it. I don't want the government involved. So yes, you have fractional reserve banking. But please remember, fractional reserve banking would be very small, because fractional reserve banking has become as big as it is today because it's government subsidized, you know, because we have a lender of last resort central bank, because we have a paper money system in which bank reserves can be constantly expanded. The banks know that they can lower their reserve ratios to absurdly low levels because they know they have a central bank that's backing them up. In an entire free market, no banking system would lower reserve levels to those kind of absurd levels. So I think I can live with that. I'm not a big fan of Hayek's denationalization of money strategy, and I explained it in more detail in my book. I think at this stage, I would just say this. You know, Hayek has this idea of having competing paper money producers, and they all can produce paper money, and they can all basically forms of elastic money, And the competition will make sure that none of them misuses that privilege. I think there are certain problems, you know, a number of problems. One is simply that it's insufficient. You know, an economy works best with one, you know, common monetary system, with one unit of money. In fact, the best thing for global capitalism would be if the entire world was on a gold standard, and the company in China and the company in Manchester, the UK, would both use the same currency unit to calculate their balance sheets and their P&L. And if the merchant from Manchester would buy something in China, that money, that gold money, would flow from the UK into China, pretty much like it flows now from New York to Arkansas or from Phoenix to Los Angeles. So in that sense, I think the idea of having all these competing paper monies is defeats the purpose of having really money, which money functions best if we all use the same. And that's why all societies have drifted towards using gold, because then they all have the same monetary standard. And the idea that that we need elastic money, just have it provided by competing users, I think that is not convincing to me. The next question is from Terry. Do you equate silver and gold when referring to owning metals should a currency collapse occur? Or another way, owning silver just as good? I get that asked a lot. I mean, I have a preference for gold, and I know I've already upset a lot of people by saying this, because I know there's some real silver advocates out there. A friend of mine said that his strongest reason for owning silver is that silver was never confiscated. I can't say if that's true. I've not researched it, but someone told me that in the history of these metals, silver has not been confiscated, gold has been confiscated. So for me, it's gold, simply because gold has a monetary use and an industrial use, but it's mainly a monetary metal. Silver is a monetary metal and an industrial metal, but it is somewhat more of an industrial metal. So I think if you look at the, they're both great monetary assets. I think gold still has the upper hand and is more of a monetary asset. So that's why I think I'm just sticking to gold. But now I learned to also mention silver, because I cannot argue against it, and I won't argue against it. But for me, my preference is with gold. Oh, sorry, Susan says that she had two questions and she ran out of space. So hopefully I'll find your questions up here, Susan. Sorry. Okay, Susan's question here was, if the free market naturally wants sound money, is it only a matter of time before sound money is brought back into play, even with central banks still operating? I'm not quite sure. So the question is, you know, at some point the market, the free market, the public wants hard money back, stable money, and will therefore launch sort of an alternative system at the same time. There are various points to make here. I think the one of the problems in switching from an inflating paper money to an either better paper money, like the foreign exchange, if it's available, or switching back to commodity money for the public, is simply that if the money users, the people who use money for daily transactions, as I said before, to a large degree, they can cope with inflation. If it's just the fact, if for example in the United States, if I was in Utah, and I understand Utah now allows, again, introduce gold and silver as legal tender. So imagine you're based in Utah, and you can transact on a daily basis in buying and selling stuff with paper dollars, which are inflating, or with a more solid gold. I mean, personally, I would keep the gold. I would keep the gold in my vault or in my safety pots. I wouldn't spend it. I didn't want to spend it, because that's my asset for when paper money collapses. As long as people accept the paper money and trade it, you use it. And the fact that it inflates, you can cope with. I think the disruptive element of paper money is obviously the fact that it leads to these capital misallocations and disrupts the saving investment equation. But that is something that the individual paper money user does not feel. And I think that's one of the reasons why inflating paper money systems last so long. There is just not a mechanism, there's no incentive for me to stop using the paper money and use a harder form of money. The inflation I can deal with. I just adjust prices in my head. And when I make long-term contracts, I just for inflation rate. As long as inflation is somewhat contained, I can cope with that. And it's just too much of too expensive and involves costs and aggravation to also have a dual currency system. And I don't even want to spend my gold. I want to keep it. So I don't want to trade with my gold. I want to store it and hoard it. So that is one of the reasons why I think this idea that some sort of competing currency system will automatically evolve, I quite don't see it. I still have to say that I like the initiative in Utah and in other states to reintroduce gold and silver as legal tender, because it will prepare the public for the moment when paper money goes into trouble. And I think the most important thing would be for these societies, for all societies that are on a paper standard now, to introduce the use of gold and silver, maybe not for daily transactions, not to buy a bus ticket, but to for people to have again gold as a monetary asset. So when things get out of shape, people don't lose all their savings, they don't lose all their money, and very quickly there is a widely distributed metal around that people can begin to use again. But I think as before you hit that point of hyperinflation, the individual money user has very little incentive to switch to harder money. The main problem with the hard money are the dislocations, capital dislocation, but they are not felt by the individual money user. I hope that answered your question. So I'm not quite sure. So here is a question from Cal. U.S. money supply is currently expanding dramatically, and banks' loans are increasing also. Why are asset prices falling? Shouldn't they soon rise due to the expanding money supply? I think you're referring to the wider aggregates. I think that's true. I think, as I said before, M2 is now probably growing at about 10%. And I also heard that more up-to-date measures of lending show that some of the American banks are more lending more. Some people I heard are suggesting that that is the reason why the Fed has refrained from hinting at quantitative easing and has only conducted operation twists. I think you're right. If banks are lending again, I think that should arrest the correction in some of these asset markets, and maybe then the equity market will do better. And I think we will ultimately see that. For me, it's always the question, which assets will rise, where does the money flow, where does it go to? It doesn't necessarily have to be equities, but I would agree with you that broadly, asset prices will not decline sharply if banks, lend again. But none of this, obviously, if this happens, if banks lend again and so the private credit process gets some momentum again, it obviously does not mean that any of the problems we accumulated have gone away. I mean, these banks will now lower their reserve ratios again, expand their balance sheet, that's what they do when they lend. So now the problem of overextended banks will over time get bigger. And the next time the economy rolls over, which is only a question of time, the whole extent of dislocations will only be bigger. This is just, if you get the banks to lend right now, I think the mainstream will say, that's great, our policy has worked and we have a recovery again. And as Austrians, we know that it's just another cycle. The Fed has finally found some traction with all that policy and zero interest rates, and the banks are lending again. But that whole process will again lead to dislocations, which will come to haunt us later. 14 trillion, I see here, someone says. I think that must be the outstanding amount of debt by the U.S. government. Yeah, that makes sense. 14 trillion is also the size of the U.S. GDP. So we're talking about 100% debt to GDP, which I think is probably where the United States is right now. So thanks for throwing that in. Is there a point when the Chinese government could or should allow the currency to rise, hence boosting domestic consumption? What do you think the consequences could be for Europe and the U.S. and the respective currencies? I think that's what everybody is waiting for. I think this could happen. I don't think it will last. I don't think it will last. I don't think that the Chinese currency will ultimately be on a lasting trajectory upwards and expand much further and rise much further, for the simple reason that China has been very aggressive, aggressively inflationist in its policy. In a way, I mean, if you look at monetary aggregates, they're growing, have been growing very, very solidly in China. People say there is an inflation problem now. The inflation problem is hugely understated. It's very clear that Chinese government is putting pressure on certain companies to not rise raise prices. They are basically hidden price controls in the Chinese system. I mean, you have to, while I'm no expert on China, from what I understand, you have to look at China as not just being one economy. There is a very dynamic part of the Chinese economy, which are the new entrepreneurs. There's a growing private sector of really sort of private companies. And if from the stories that I hear, many people say that, you know, for many of these entrepreneurs, it's easier to do business in China now than in the United States. It's for them, it's business friendly. It's pretty much a free market. But China is at the same time a communist country. A lot of the investment projects are run by politicians and bureaucrats. They're powerful local heads of the local regions. The banks are mainly all under control of the government, and they lend aggressively. They have been, you know, after the 2008 crisis, or after the Lehman collapse and the 2008 period of the crisis, Chinese banks were told by the government to expand rapidly, and they did. So there are massive dislocations. I mean, China has a massive real estate boom, which is entirely credit funded. And if you look at the size of real estate investment as a percentage of GDP, the numbers are now bigger than at the peak of the real estate boom in Japan. They are now bigger than at the peak of the real estate boom in the United States. There are estimates that in China there are 65 million apartments that have no electricity, which basically means people bought these apartments on credit. The value of an apartment is maintained at a higher level if nobody has ever lived in it, if it's new. So that these apartments don't even have electricity. Nobody lives in them. They've just been bought for speculative purposes. So 65 million apartments like this, there is potentially a gigantic bubble in terms of real estate investment, in terms of other infrastructure investment. And even some of the big companies, I mean, there are political projects, here, big companies are being started and expanded in certain parts of China for political reasons, out of prestige. So all of that is credit funded. So what I'm saying is, you know, credit, China may have still that sort of version of a credit bubble, and the turn from an artificial credit boom into a bust. That may still come for China. And if that happens, I don't think the Chinese currency is going to rise tremendously. So, my longer-term outlook is quite the other way from the standard approach, which is like China is so strong and powerful, and therefore, if they let their currency rise, if they stop the pack, it means the currency can only strengthen. I'm not sure that will happen. There's one question by Michael. I'm interested in how I can track the selling of or the lack of confidence in U.S., Japanese, and German bonds. I mean, straight answer for me would be I just look at the yields, you know, and compare them simply to, you know, the debt situation and the inflation rate. I mean, you know, U.S. 10-year treasuries were for weeks now below 2%, the inflation rate is 3%, the budget deficit is 10%. I mean, there's no hope in hell that they can control, you know, this budget deficit or, you know, bring the economy, bring the fiscal situation under control. In my view, I mean, I'm bearish on the fiscal outlook. So looking at that situation, I think it tells me that there's massive confidence, you know, because simply the fundamentals would point to different yields. So for me, it's simply just looking at the low yields. If they stay low, there is still a confidence. One thing you can also look at is obviously, if you have access to it, it's not that straightforward. Look at credit default swaps. But it's very interesting in recent weeks in Europe that the credit default swaps on German government debt began to widen. So it means the market is now asking for a higher premium to insure German government debt. Now, if you follow the European debt crisis, it's clear that, you know, these credit default swaps widen massively for some of the fiscally weaker countries like Italy or Spain. So insuring that debt in the swap market has become very expensive. But Germany was always the benchmark and was regarded as the soundest. It's still the soundest, relatively speaking, but the cost of insuring against a German default has gone up only tiny bits. But I think that's something to watch, because if that continues, it's clear that confidence tends to evaporate. Paul says, people call Social Security a Ponzi scheme, but is it fair to say that our commercial banking system is even worse because it's based on paper? For example, if everyone wants to withdraw cash deposits at the same time, the system will implode. That is correct. I think it is a Ponzi scheme. I think so is Social Security. It's all a Ponzi scheme. Both systems depend on nobody pulling out. People keep money in and putting more money in. I think it's safe to call both a Ponzi scheme. It's definitely the case with fractional reserve banking. I mean, there's one question that always is being debated among even Austrians or libertarians. It's like, is fractional reserve banking fraud? And I don't think it's fraud, because I do think that most people now understand that banks do not keep the money we deposit in a bank, on deposit. The banks do not offer safekeeping services. And I think, if I may say so, I think that even Murray Rothbard was wrong when he said, like, all the depositors are basically being cheated because they expect the bank to provide safekeeping services. Banks don't provide safekeeping services. Banks are not in the business of providing safekeeping services. And the way you can find that out really quick is, if you give your money to the bank, you are not paying the bank for looking after your money and safekeeping it. The bank pays you because they get control of the money and they can lend it. So the interest rate you get on your deposit is a clear indication that that money is not being looked after, but is being spent and used and lent. So it's a Ponzi scheme, but I think it's one in which the depositor willingly participates because he gets the deposit. And I think now so many people participate in it because many people, at least, I think, understand that it's underwritten by the printing press. I think here is one of the points I come back to the earlier question. What would happen if we go back, stop the printing press, go back to a gold standard? I think banks would have to work with much higher reserve ratios, because the depositors will participate as depositors in the fractional reserve banking Ponzi scheme. Now run a higher risk. If Citibank or Deutsche Bank or other banks now have very low reserve ratios, most depositors don't care, because if they want to go to that bank and take all their money out in cash, then know that if push comes to shove, the central bank will print the money, ship it out to Citibank or Deutsche Bank or wherever, and they can hand that paper money to you. So you run an inflation risk, but not so much a risk that the Ponzi scheme collapses. If you go back to a gold standard, reserve ratios will be much higher. Kel says, wouldn't an unfettered debt deflation result in the wiping out of all fiduciary media? Wouldn't prices therefore fall by over 90% and in a very short time frame? Not that I would mind. wipe out all fiduciary media? So would an unfettered debt deflation wipe out all fiduciary media? I don't think so. I don't think so, for the reason that I think it comes back to the earlier point, about would I prohibit fractional reserve banking? No, I would not. And I think in an entirely free market, there would be some, fractional reserve banking. So what that means is that I think a market would probably be willing to accept some of the fiduciary media. Not everybody would, be shocked if some of the money or money claims or balance sheet items on banks were not backed by gold. And I think we know from the history of banking that for a long time people accepted that. I think it then went frequently wrong, that to bank runs and business cycles and collapses, and maybe at some stage we learn to manage that somewhat better. And I remain of the view that fractional reserve banking has a destabilizing influence on the economy. But I do not think that nobody in a free market, there would be no room whatsoever for some fractional reserve banking. I fully agree with Mises that it's not needed. It's not needed, and I show that in my book. If there was 100% reserve banking, 100% gold standard, it would not mean that we have slower economic growth, or as some of the mainstream economists would maintain, that we would not have any economic growth at all, because you know, we need inflation and money creation to have the economy function properly. That's nonsense. You know, we could live with 100% with no fiduciary media and 100% sort of hard gold standard. But I don't think that right now the system would liquidate everything other than just the gold basis. But I do think it would be a major deflation. I think it probably would be. I think we would have to work with a smaller banking industry, a smaller financial market. But I don't think that, you know, all banks and all fiduciary media would have to be liquidated. It's an interesting question, though, and I'm the ultimate judge for that is the market. Charles asks, in the Weimar Republic meltdown, what did the German population do to combat the massive inflation? Did gold begin to circulate in the underground market? Well, that's a very good question. I have to say I'm not a big expert on it. I'll probably have to read Adam Ferguson's book again, When Money Dies, which has been a bit of a bestseller recently. I think what you definitely saw in Germany is that, again, the population goes back to some form of commodity money. Gold in the underground market if it's prohibited by the government. But, you know, remember, people use cigarettes, and the cigarettes have been usually very common. Also, after the Second World War in Germany for a while, you know, cigarettes almost circulated in the economy as almost like a second form of money. So I think the population goes back to these kind of items. What you saw in Germany very clearly is also the what Mises called the cracker boom. You know, people trying to get rid of their money balances as fast as they could and bought whatever they could buy. Very 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 quickly. Again, I'm not really a historian on the German situation, so I can't talk about the specifics so much about the German hyperinflation. But I think if we go through another period like this, I do think very quickly the market would come up with with underground markets in gold and gold and silver coins. I think jewelry would be very important. I think that would be items that people will use and trade. And I think, as is usually the case, I mean, the human creativity and ingenuity knows no bounds. I mean, there will be entrepreneurs popping up, you know, whether they're on the black market or on the legal market, who will find ways to provide a medium of exchange. Exchanges will pop up by which, you know, maybe things like jewelry or other things are being assessed and then can function as money. I mean, all of this is obviously not efficient and sufficient to run a modern economy. And that's why I think when a currency collapse occurs, it is usually a crisis that is very severe and very disruptive also for the social fabric of a society, but that is not long-lasting. You know, a modern economy cannot operate on such a system, on cigarettes or even on gold coins, to be honest. And so I think that in that collapse will be hard and quick, and then a new system needs to pick up fairly quickly. What stops the Fed from lowering or eliminating the interest rate it pays on reserves that it holds? Seems like a simple move to increase the velocity of money in the economy. Absolutely correct. I fully agree with you. Nothing stops them. They could do this right away. I think the reason they don't want to do this is because, you know, they are a bit nervous about what it will mean to inflation. And remember that about a year ago when Bernanke gave that famous interview, that television interview, he maintained this point that we are not printing money, which obviously is a bizarre statement for him to make. He just created $1.7 trillion. Well, I mean, when he gave the interview, maybe it was only $1 trillion. He just had created $1 trillion out of nothing, and he said we're not printing money. But he was referring to the wider aggregates, and it was clear to him that he can only make that statement because they're paying interest on the deposits and not really let them out through the gates into the broader economy. So I think he is conscious that, and they are nervous that if they cut the interest rate on that completely, you know, velocity could shoot up too massively. And please remember the slide I had earlier where I said, like, what could trigger a loss of confidence. So I think if they let that money go, if they cut the interest rate to zero, that money circulates, and maybe, as someone mentioned before, maybe banks are already willing to lend a little bit more, and they get an extra dose of that reserve money coming in, and suddenly, you know, the inflation rate pops up on 3 to 5%. And then suddenly your people get concerned about inflation, real interest rates shoot up, your interest rates go up, obviously the credit expansion immediately comes to a stop. And in this environment, the Fed then has to print more money again. So I think they are probably conscious of the fact that they need to be very careful here. If they do something that undermines the confidence of the public here, things can turn very, very ugly. And once you lose that confidence, it's very difficult to regain it. I mean, you would have to run a really tight monetary policy with higher interest rates to regain confidence in your monetary unit. And as we all know, given the present dislocations, that would pull the rug from under, you know, large parts of the U.S. economy. So in a way, yes, technically they could do it. Nothing stops them. They could do it. And I think maybe if the economy is weak, they will do it. But the risks are also apparent. And then there is a question from Zach. So when you're next in London, definitely come over and sign a copy of your book, of my book, that's fine. Adrian, after a fiat money collapse, what is your view for the future? Is there a potential for a return to a gold standard system, or would politicians push for a more centralized international fiat standard? I think, Adrian, that's a great question. That's an excellent question. And I'll be very honest, I really, really, really don't know. I think if I look, all the work I did on my book was really focused on the point of showing that the present system is unsustainable. That was really my key message, and I wrote this book to make people realize that, you know, the system shouldn't even be saved. There's no advantages. It must undermine the economy, and the present system we have is not even compatible with capitalism. And I think from my 19 years in financial markets, I felt that this is a message that is goes completely against accepted common wisdom in the financial industry to such a degree that, you know, people would just not take it seriously. So I had to sit down and write that book. So all my effort has been in showing that the present system can't last, and that it will collapse, and then how it will collapse. Now, I get now often asked, what should the system look that comes out in the end? And to be honest, I have certain ideas. I mean, I think it should be gold-based, should be commodity-based. I've been asked whether it could be Bitcoin. You know, I assume some of you have heard of it. You know, this new virtual currency. And there are a lot of things I like about Bitcoin. First and foremost, the fact that it's not issued by a state. It's not a political tool. It cannot be a political tool. It's an algorithm. And it's an algorithm that is designed in such a way that the supply of Bitcoin, the supply of money, is fixed. I mean, that's exactly my point. It's completely inelastic money. Apolitical inelastic money is very good, but I'm not quite sure if it will be accepted in its competition with gold, which has a 3,000-year history. So I think it will be a gold system. I hope it will be a privately run system, not a state system. But, you know, even the state system, like the classical gold system, would be preferable to the system we have right now. That's also an option. But I think the point you mentioned about an international fiat standard system is interesting. And I think it's interesting. It's something that I don't want to go. I think it would be wrong and would be a complete disaster. But I think what is very clear here is that as Austrians and libertarians, we deep down, we are all concerned about this crisis because it will affect us and people we know and our friends and family. So I'm not looking forward to this paper money collapse. I wrote the book, but I'm not enjoying going through this experience of a collapsing monetary system. But there's part of all of us that we say, okay, at least constrains the state ultimately. You know, printing money and controlling the monetary sphere is a hugely powerful tool for the state. So if you're a libertarian, you should wish for the system to end. And if we then go back to some form of gold money or a privately run system or even a state run gold standard, it is a straitjacket for the state. And as libertarians, that's what we want. But there is one big risk here. Now, as we go through this crisis, there are always those who ask for more state interference, who don't see the problem with, you know, our monetary system, who don't see the problem with, with a badly designed monetary infrastructure, but we see the problem with markets and, you know, speculation and all that kind of stuff. And we can see, I think, liberty and individual freedom will be under attack in this crisis. So I think the pendulum could go the other way. And while we may be joyous now about sort of the prospect of the state losing this ability to print money and fund ever larger deficits at some stage, you know, there is that risk that, you know, we get some international fiat standard and some massive push in the other direction. I think it's unlikely. I don't think it's the most likely outcome. I do still think that the other outcomes are more likely, simply because I do think that people ultimately, want a market economy, and we all need a market economy, and people will realize that for that they need hard apolitical money. But there's always a risk that in the crisis, the state will assert more power, not less, and that something crazy like a centralized international fiat standard could be erected. So not my main scenario, not my main outcome, but definitely a risk. I think that was the last question, and I think we had about 2 hours now.
Thank you so much, Detlev, for spending so much time answering all those questions. And thank you so much for the attendees for asking great questions. I have a question myself. I'm from Taiwan. Do you think that Taiwan has been inflating along with China? And is Taiwan's economy really intimately linked with China's economy?
Well, you got me there, Danny. I'm not really an expert on Taiwan or its link to China. My assumption would be that the link is very, very strong, and I think that a lot of the Asian region, I can also see that from my recent trip there, is so closely now linked to the Chinese economy. I mean, it's also Singapore and other countries in the area, all the way down to even Australia and New Zealand, who have now redirected a lot of their trade flows to China. So a lot of that region has become dependent on this massive growth engine there in China. My suspicion is that, you know, the way it's often portrayed in the West is too simple, which is like this great idea about a never-ending boom in China. It's so many people, you know, we're all in awe of the size of it, and that therefore for some strange reason, people even think that the idea of a managed economy is something that the Chinese have finally worked out, which completely amazes me, you know, from all we know about, you know, economics and the free market system. A managed economy does not work, and China is in large part still a communist, country, it's still a state-run economy, with all the problems that the Austrian told us about. So what I'm saying is, yes, I think you're right, there's a huge dependence on these states around China, and it goes way beyond even Taiwan. It goes, many countries in the region are now being connected to this massive boom in China. But I fear that boom is built on a lot of hot air. I do think that a lot of that is based on money printing on a gigantic scale. I mean, as I said in one of my recent blogs, the most levered institution on the planet is no doubt the People's Republic Bank of China, the People's Bank of China, the Chinese Central Bank. Its leverage ratio is 1,200 to 1. I mean, its assets are 1,200 times its capital. It has accumulated these massive foreign exchange balances, but it gives you a sense of, like, you know, how much money is also produced domestically and often channeled through politically organized channels. So I'm saying is China will have a big crisis. I think over the next couple of years that could be a major effect on the world economy if China falls over. And I think if that is the case, we have another leg down the global economy. And who knows? That could be the point when the Western central banks go into overkill and print even more money, expand their balance sheets by another few trillion dollars or euros, and that could be the point when the public loses confidence. So I'm not at all positive on China. China in the long run, yes, but in the near term, I think they got massive problems.
Wow. Well, thank you again, and everybody make sure to check out Detlev's blog at papermoneycollapse.com. And check out his book, Paper Money Collapse. Thank you so much, Detlev.
Thanks so much. And if there are any questions that I haven't answered, I mean, if you go to my blog, you can also see there's a contact line there. You can send me emails. I will get them. I will try to answer all of them. Thanks so much for your time, and have a great weekend. Thank you.